Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
On Thursday, Vice President Kamala Harris took the White House Economic Recovery Plan straight to the people of West Virginia.
And the reason I am here in West Virginia talking with you is because everybody matters, whether you voted for us or not, that the election is over. And now is the time to support the American people, to lead, to lift people up, and to say hello, neighbor.
Harris appeared on local TV station WSAZ, but some of her attempts at being neighborly fell flat.
Job creation around investing in American manufacturing, job creation in terms of investing in American infrastructure and building up, back up American infrastructure, job creation around, for example, all of those skilled workers who are in the coal industry and transferring those skills to what we need to do in terms of dealing with reclaiming abandoned landmines.
Vice President there most likely meant abandoned mine lands. Well, the interview caught the eye of West Virginia's Democratic Senator Joe Manchin.
I saw it. I couldn't believe it. No one called me. We're going to try to find a bipartisan pathway forward. I think we need to, but we need to work together. That's not a way of working together, what was done.
Manchin is talking about current negotiations over the Biden administration's $1.9 trillion COVID relief package. Can President Biden afford to draw the West Virginia senator's ire? Well, Manchin is a Democrat in a ruby-red state, and now with the Senate split 50-50, Senator Joe Manchin finds himself at the center of influence on Capitol Hill, potentially the deciding vote on any number of contentious proposals. And given political realities in Congress, that means most, if not all, of President Biden's legislative ambitions. Senator Manchin, though, is well aware of his influence right now. He spoke about that power on CNN's State of the Union last month.
I've seen power in Washington.
Yeah.
And I've seen people abuse power. If you think you've got it, usually they end up abusing it. If I'm in a position that I can make a difference by bringing this country back together and making us work in a bipartisan, I'll use it for that.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today on Point, understanding Senator Joe Manchin and understanding how he'll sway the Senate. We're going to start today with On Point News analyst Jack Beattie. He joins us from Hanover, New Hampshire. Hello there, Jack.
Hello, Meghna.
So we're going to hear more about the very interesting aspects of Senator Manchin's biography. But I was wondering if you could get us started today, Jack, because it's a really interesting time for a Democrat of West Virginia to hold such sway on Capitol Hill. Put Manchin in the context of America's sort of national evolution over the past couple of decades.
Well, his state, West Virginia, epitomizes a national trend. Today, population density is the single strongest predictor of partisanship. The fewer people per square mile, the stronger the GOP, which has increased by 10% in rural areas in the decade. This trend holds true in blue states. Otis, Massachusetts, a Trump town, is not a metropolis. In California, the Trump counties, heavy Trump counties, are nestled against the Oregon border, Modoc, Siskiyou. It holds true, this trend, in red states. Take Wyoming. Trump got 88% of the vote in Crook County, which is located in Wyoming's northeastern corner, far from the madding crowd in Casper. And the trend holds true overwhelmingly in West Virginia, which at 77 people per square mile, compare Virginia with 200, is among the nation's most rural states. What's different and anomalous, really, about West Virginia is how fast it has conformed to the national trend and how far it had to go. Campaigning there in 1960, John F. Kennedy was struck by the virtual shrines to FDR in home after home in West Virginia. Between the time of FDR and today, West Virginia has elected only two Republican governors. In 1992, as recently as that, Clinton won the state by 13 points. Trump won it last year by 41 points. It can't be because of GOP policies. Trump, one of his major initiatives was to repeal Obamacare. That would have cost nearly 200,000 West Virginians their health care, would have cost nearly 20,000 jobs. So it's very difficult to see why. What explains this political transformation in West Virginia, and how it is that Joe Manchin has been able to stick it out there as practically the lone Democrat running in the state. Perhaps some experts on the ground there could explain.
Aha. Uh-huh. And Jack, as you well know, we have such an expert. So fascinating transformation then in West Virginia. And joining us now from Buchanan, West Virginia, is Robert Rupp, professor of political science and history at West Virginia Wesleyan College and author of The Primary That Made a President, Kennedy and the 1960 Battleground in West Virginia. Professor Rupp, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for inviting me and deciding to take a look at West Virginia political landscape.
Very eager to learn as much as we can this hour. So why don't we start with the question that Jack has set up for us here. As we've seen the rapid sort of political change, at least when it comes to presidential elections in West Virginia over the past couple of decades, what explains Joe Manchin's longevity as a West Virginia Democrat there?
Well, you first have to realize that for more than 70 years, this was a highly Democratic state, as Jack said, even as recently as Clinton. But while West Virginia has always had a two-party system, they've never had a competitive two-party system. So between 1930 and 2000, it was totally Democrat. Republicans couldn't even fill candidates for a statewide office. But then we had a beginning of an almost 20-year slow change from totally Democrat to now totally Republicans. And what you have here is a transformation that Joe has been able to live through. And, you know, to be honest with you, when he initially came to Washington, he felt at the edges. He wasn't appreciated. And right now, as Jack and you pointed out, he's in the catbird seat.
Without a doubt. I want to understand more, though, what drove that transformation, right, from being a blue Democratic state, just what you were talking Clinton, right? So now it's 30 years ago, to being ruby red today. So let's do that by starting off with what West Virginia was. I mean, you both you and Jack are familiar with that 1960 primary in West Virginia. You wrote a book about it, Professor Rupp. Actually, let's start there. Can you describe to us what a West Virginia Democrat was in 1960?
In 1960, they had FDR's portrait in almost every household, or seemed it on that side. It was a New Deal Democrat starting in 1930, and was passed to at least two generations of New Deal Democrats. So when Kennedy comes in, he has to make the promise. They said, who is this millionaire Catholic from Boston? And what he said is, he said, you support me and I will support you. And now a lot of those cabins after 1963 had not only FDR, but they had JFK, because those were two presidents who went out of their way to pay attention and help the state.
Hmm. Jack, you wanna chime in a little bit more about West Virginia circa 1960?
Well, I'm curious, what was it about the New Deal that so appealed to West Virginians, that made them so loyal so long, even against these national trends toward rural areas going Republican?
FDR gave him not only attention, but support. Remember, they were really suffering. And second of all, what did he give them? Unions. That was the beginning of the coal union movement. So that was the two things that FDR delivered to West Virginia.
And so, but so that then that that support of FDR and Rooseveltian approaches to government actually persisted through what, the 90s, you're saying?
Yeah, it wasn't until 2000 that you actually had this trend. In Alabama, it just took like 4 years to transform. In West Virginia, it took like 20. It was slow. It started with Bush winning in 2000 and mainly shifted the election. And then over the next 20 years, you had Republicans appear in the congressional delegation that used to be totally Democrat. And it was just this, and now they've taken over the legislature in 8 years ago. So again, as I said, it's really now a one-party state. So the question is, how can Joe survive? Mm-hmm. And he does.
So I want to talk specifically about Senator Manchin, of course, in a few more minutes. But what was different, or what was that first domino in 2000 that then began this change that you're talking about, Professor Rupp?
Well, it became a whole set of conservative issues. I remember Gore desperately trying to say he had commercial, had him saying he was pro-gun. And that wasn't being bought. And the other one, too, is you have to realize that Trump may not have delivered very much to West Virginia, but his promise was, I will keep coal. And Hillary Clinton was seen as an anti-coal person. And although the coal industry had been dropping, it's very important. In fact, do you know what's on our state flag besides a farmer? A coal miner.
So the cultural importance of the coal industry is something that we're going to want to explore a bit later in the show. Professor Robert Rupp and Jack Beatty, stand by. This hour, we're trying to understand Senator Joe Manchin and understand how he will sway the Senate. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In this hour, we are trying to understand Senator Joe Manchin, Democrat from West Virginia and now possibly the most influential person on Capitol Hill when it comes to deciding the fate of legislation in the Senate. And therefore, we're trying to understand how Joe Manchin will sway the Senate. I'm joined today by Jack Beatty. He's On Point News analyst. Robert Rupp also joins us. He's a professor of political science and history at West Virginia Wesleyan College and author of The Primary That Made a President, Kennedy and the 1960 Battleground in West Virginia. And let's listen back to a little bit of the sort of political family that Senator Manchin comes from, because his uncle, A. James Manchin, was a politician who served as West Virginia's Secretary of State. And here's James Manchin explaining his perception of politicians in the early 1980s television program Real People.
We're as real as anybody else. But you know why? Sometimes politicians are afraid, and why they deal in platitudes
is because they're afraid if they say something or take a stand, the people out there may not like it. Mm-hmm. So stay right in the middle. Be very careful. Don't offend anyone.
That's A. James Manchin, Senator Joe Manchin's uncle, from a 1980s interview on the television program Real People. Now, that don't offend anyone call has become increasingly difficult in the very fractious and divided politics of modern America. Senator Manchin has had to face that reality. For example, after he announced that he would vote to confirm former President Trump's pick for the Supreme Court, Brett Kavanaugh, back in 2018, protesters surrounded Senator Manchin and chanted, "Shame on you." And here he is speaking to a reporter.
Senator, do you think that there's still a place in the Democratic Party for you after this?
I'm just a West Virginian. I'm just a good old West Virginian.
You're up for re-election in a difficult race. Are you concerned the base?
Senator Joe Manchin in 2018. Well, joining us now is Belinda Biafor. She is with us from Fairmont, West Virginia, and she's chairwoman of the West Virginia Democratic Party. Welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me on.
So, you know that question that you just heard a reporter asking Senator Manchin back in 2018, quote, "Do you think there's still a place in the Democratic Party for him?" How do you think he'd answer that question today?
Well, I don't think it would be any different. I think he would say absolutely.
And so tell me more. How long have you known Joe Manchin?
I grew up with Joe Manchin. We're both from the same hometown in Marion County. And so I've known he and his family for several years.
Okay. And so tell us then about growing up in Marion County and how understanding that would helps us understand Joe Manchin and his approach to politics.
Well, it's a small community. He was in Farmington. I was in Fairmont, which is about 10 miles away. But they were both small hometown. Everybody knew everybody. If you got in trouble on the streets, you knew one of your neighbors was going to call your parents and let them know what you did. But it was also a community where everybody helped everybody. If you were down on your luck, we were there to help you. And Joe Manchin will tell you that story over and over about his grandmother and grandfather. If there was somebody hungry, they'd bring him in and feed him. They'd help him find a job. They'd help him get back on their feet. And I think that him being raised that way has helped make him who he is today.
Huh. So give me some other examples of how you see that in terms of how he's been trying to navigate that middle road, whatever the middle is in America these days, as a senator.
Yeah, you know, in West Virginia, it always takes us a little longer to catch up with the rest of the nation. It took us a long time, but the Republicans have finally taken over in West Virginia. But, you know, as far as Joe Manchin, no matter what office he was in, and that was another thing about him. He worked his way up so that he knew every phase of government. He started out in 1988 in the House of Delegates, worked his way to the state Senate, ran for governor and lost. And I think that loss taught him a lot, ran for Secretary of State, and then on to be a successful governor and now senator. Hmm. But, you know, I remember when we would have executive committee meetings and, you know, I would just get beat up and people would be bashing on Joe Manchin and they didn't like the way he voted. They didn't like what he said. And it was just on and on. And I went to him several times and he said to me, get him in a room. So we put this meeting together. He comes in, he brings his coffee, his donuts. He looks around the room. He starts giving him the word of the day. And he says, "Are there any questions?" And there were a few softball questions. And on the way out the door, folks would stop and get their hug from him, stop and get a picture with him. And he turned around, looked at me, and he said, "I thought they were mad." And he walked out the door. And so he's got this way about him when he was governor. If there was a piece of legislation, he talked to the Republicans and the Democrats, even though the Democrats had the majority and could pass anything he wanted. He brought them in. He sat them down at the table. And if there was an issue they didn't agree on, they didn't get out of that room until they came to some type of compromise or agreement. So he's just always had that style about him, and he continues with it through the Senate.
Huh. Robert Rupp, did you want to add to that?
Yes, I totally agree. Joe is expert at retail politics, one, because he learned it, but more important, because of his personality. He practices face-to-face politics and meeting. And he's also, as she said, highly bipartisan. Even when the Democrats were in control of the state, he would reach across and talk to Republicans.
And Jack Beatty, what do you think?
Well, that's a model of a man in the middle, when, as you say, when the middle is being squeezed. But I'm struck by this. Robert C. Byrd is, of course, the great figure of modern West Virginia. And I've been looking at it. There's something like 60 different facilities, from highways to healthcare centers, named for Senator Byrd or his wife, Mrs. Irma Byrd. And what was that all about? Well, it helped make West Virginia ninth in federal spending in terms of its of money sent in by the federal government. And the key to that was earmarks. So, but of course, John McCain famously got rid of earmarks. So now Joe Biden, if he wants Joe Manchin's vote, can't say to him, how about that highway? I can build that for you. He can't do what LBJ did to Frank Church, the senator from Idaho, when Church, in a Senate speech against the Vietnam War, quoted Walter Lippmann. LBJ said to Frank Church, Frank, why don't you have Walter Lippmann build that dam on the Snake River? You can't do that anymore, and that makes it, from the point of view of the President Biden, it makes it harder to sort of bring Joe Manchin aboard.
Right. Jack, you're right about how Byrd used earmarks, but there's a saying here that Byrd knew someone in every town, but Joe Manchin knew that person's relatives as well. And Byrd used earmarks. And Joe is using personality and retail politics, which are fading, but he does it well.
Belinda, did you want to add to that?
No, I absolutely agree. And I think there are other ways that the president will be able to help, not through earmarks, but by helping us build back something that can put these coal miners back to work. And I think Joe's been looking at that for a long time.
Okay, so for every right reason, this is what the third time in this conversation that coal mining has come up, because it is central to West Virginia's history and cultural sense of self. So I want to talk about that a little bit more, given the fact that one of the big platforms or planks of the platform that President Biden ran on had to do with climate. So, for example, first of all, let's hear from Senator Manchin himself. He answered questions on Capitol Hill last week about one of the Biden administration's recent decisions, executive orders, and this one was specifically to pause the Keystone XL pipeline project and other climate-related executive actions. And here's what Senator Manchin said.
Well, they've taken some pauses. I think we have a chance to sit down and look at what's going on, what we've done right, what we've done wrong, what we can do better. Yeah, I'm just saying we're open to all the discussions and we'll be having them.
Including the actions they've taken so far, like Keystone?
Yeah, Keystone, we just have a disagreement there.
All right. I appreciate the...
Really, it's just true that we just have a disagreement, and we have to look at it, and they have to look at the safety factors. They have to look at the safety factors, and basically I've had a train blow up in my state. I know that product's still coming to the United States. Mm-hmm. I think it's safer to come by pipe than it is by road or rail. So we'll have those discussions. I think that... They're taking some pauses on things, and that's fine. They can do that, and we should sit down and look at it. Maybe they have facts I don't know.
By the way, Senator Manchin there was referring to a 2015 train explosion in West Virginia, the train that was carrying crude oil derailed and violently exploded. That was a 2015 disaster that happened in the state. Now, about... fossil fuels and coal mining, we spoke with Angie Rosser, executive director of the West Virginia Rivers Coalition. She says a coal-centered economy is a way of life in West Virginia.
To hear about an aggressive climate plan is difficult because it can be perceived as an assault or an affront to a way of life or a cultural identity that has been very much part of West Virginia and Appalachia. The fact of the matter is places like West Virginia have helped power the country, electrified the country for decades, and that we have bared the burden of that, whether it's been environmental degradation, health concerns. So it's in some ways time to pay us back for that.
Rosser also worries that her neighbors in West Virginia will get left behind when it comes to climate change solutions developed in Washington.
Back home, we're excited to see Senator Manchin in a leadership position because he brings that perspective. He brings that complexity, that view of, yes, we need to act on climate. Yes, we need to evolve and transition to renewable energy. But in doing that, we also need to take care of workers and communities and people.
That's Angie Rosser. She's executive director of the West Virginia Rivers Coalition. Now, Belinda, I do wonder if the profound historical and cultural importance of coal in West Virginia makes it hard to see what the truth of West Virginia's current economy is. Because, for example, we were looking at some numbers from the Bureau of Labor Statistics about employment in West Virginia as of November 2020. And the BLS says that mining and logging in November of 2020, there were some 18,000 people employed in West Virginia in those industries, 18,000. Whereas for education and health services in West Virginia, same month, there are 123,000, almost 124,000 West Virginians employed in just that one other industry. So help us understand here. Why does how do we understand the difference between what the economy currently is in West Virginia versus the continued focus on coal mining?
I think the biggest focus on coal mining comes from mostly southern West Virginia because those jobs were never replaced down there. Mm. You know, we've got one county, McDowell, that we've got to actually bring teachers in to that community. They've got a project rebuilding McDowell where they have a housing project teachers can live in. But I think the goal that Senator Manchin has had for quite some time is a way to retrain those folks in southern West Virginia or bringing something to them that they can get jobs. When our governor was running the first time around, you know, he was big on agriculture and he said he was going to bring agriculture to southern West Virginia. Never happened. So I think we're just missing something. You're right. The coal jobs are down, even though the former president promised he was going to bring jobs back. And people have held on to that belief. And a lot of the coal miners, that's all they ever knew. That's all they don't have an education. All they knew was coal mining. And so until somebody comes in and says, here's what we're going to do for you.
Yeah.
I think we still need to make it a priority.
Robert Rupp, go ahead.
Well, what do we see here? FDR, JFK, will it be Joe? All of them looked at West Virginia and said it needs help and we're going to provide it. But over the last 20 years, I've seen more and more politicians admit that coal is going down and we have to make a changeover. And now virtually that's part of every West Virginia. We got to make a changeover. And I think that the question for us is what happens to those coal miners that are left behind as we see the cost of climate reform?
Absolutely. And this is such a critical question, right? And it's a critical question for the Democratic Party, for President Biden, because bringing everybody along in trying to transform the U.S. economy and helping all Americans, I mean, President Biden says it every day. He wants to be a president for every American. So it is a critical question. So I wonder, Belinda, help us understand something then. I mean, already in this conversation, we've heard, Roosevelt, the New Deal, West Virginia needs help. West Virginia even wants help. And yet we find Senator Manchin in the position of, in his quote-unquote moderate position, being a voice that might advocate for negotiating down the ambitions of Biden's COVID relief package, whereas this is a relief package, if the whole thing gets pushed through, could stand to do the very thing we're talking about, help West Virginia. Why would he want to negotiate that down?
Just from what I've heard him say and in conversations we've had, I don't think he wants to do away with it. I think he just wants to bring it real. I don't think he wants to add more debt onto our grandchildren, but at the same time, he wants to help West Virginians that are struggling. And to him, folks that are making $250,000 to $300,000 a year aren't struggling. So, you know, we just need to take a look at the formula and maybe take better care of those, you know, down ballot, or not down ballot, but those that aren't making as much, and help them before we just one swipe and give everybody a check.
Jack Beattie, we've just got about 30 seconds before we have to take our next break, but your thoughts on that?
Well, they need help. I mean, when you look at the data, West Virginia, 46,000 median income, that's nearly 20,000 less than the national. And it's the only state, according to the census, that has lost population in recent years. So people are hurting there, and they do need help.
Well, we are talking this hour about West Virginia Democratic Senator Joe Manchin and understanding how he, in his newfound position at the center of power in the Senate, will sway the Senate. Belinda Biafor, chairwoman of the West Virginia Democratic Party, it was great to have you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Professor Robert Rupp and Jack, stand by for a moment. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to talk about GameStop and how a group of Redditors put the short squeeze on billion-dollar hedge funds on Wall Street. So we want to know, what's your question? Do you really understand what happened with the GameStop stock? And if you do, call us and let us know what you think really happened, because is this a David versus Goliath story, or is this actually a Goliath versus Goliath story? So what are your questions about the GameStop story? What do you think it reveals about how Wall Street works? And what do you think it means we ought to do in terms of further financial regulation, if any at all? Give us a call at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. Today, though, we are talking about Senator Joe Manchin, Democrat of West Virginia, and now the most influential member of the United States Senate, given that 50-50 split. And so we're trying to understand him as a politician and how he might sway the Senate. And I'm joined today by Jack Beattie, On Point News analyst, and Robert Rupp is also with us. He's professor of political science and history at West Virginia Wesleyan College and author of The Primary That Made a President, Kennedy and the 1960 Battleground in West Virginia. So I want to spend the rest of the show really focusing on where Manchin finds himself now. And the most immediate question, of course, as we've discussed or begun to discuss, is that COVID relief plan that President Biden has put out. So let's listen to a little bit to what Senator Manchin has recently said about his view of stimulus checks for all Americans.
People need to know, we want to help everybody that needs help. But if a person's making $250,000 or $300,000, I don't think they're in much as need as a person making $40,000 or $50,000 that's been okay. That's all I've said.
So, Robert Rupp, I wanted to ask you to just reflect on this with me, because Senator Manchin there, you know, correctly insisting he's only been explicit about his concerns regarding those stimulus checks, and the Biden proposal wants to send them to all Americans. But he's a smart guy. I mean, he knows that it's not just those stimulus checks that the Republicans want to push for quote-unquote compromise on. I mean, we have this new GOP alternative plan that's, what, less than a third of what Biden has proposed, and critically scales back unemployment benefits, which I imagine might have an impact on a lot of West Virginians, and it doesn't include state and local government aid as well. So it's more than just the stimulus checks. I mean, how do you read how Joe Manchin might handle these other pressures to compromise that he's facing right now?
Well, I think a key is not just his background and his personality, but also his focus. And his focus is West Virginia, if you really want to start understanding him. And in that case, it's why give it to rich people when poor people need it more? I think that's just part of it, though. But I was not surprised that he said that. But I'll tell you also, his personality is one to compromise and barter and change. And I don't think I think we will not see him, as you pointed out, as this obstructionist that isn't really helping the nation. I think he might come around. At least that's my prediction.
Mm. Well, Jack, I just want to hear you quickly on this, and then we're going to hear a voice from Capitol Hill. But what do you think about the bigger pressures sort of across the board, the pushback that the GOP is putting on the Biden plan, and what impact that might have on how Manchin tries to navigate through it?
Well, I think it's significant that he goes right to the weakest part of that Biden plan. We've talked about it on this program. Economists have said, you know, people, you give the check to people earning over $75,000 and they put it in the bank. And that's got no bounce effect in the economy. So I think he's on firm ground there. And it sounds like the president is willing to give on that. But, you know, we've been talking about Joe as if he, you know, sort of is the man in the middle and doesn't take chances. He took one of the biggest chances of any senator in recent decades, I think, when after the Sandy Hook massacre, he went out and co-sponsored a gun control bill. Didn't get a vote because of the grip of the gun lobby on the GOP. But it was darn brave, and I'm sure he suffered from it in a gun-owning state.
Mm. Did he suffer from that, Professor Rupp?
No. As I said, Joe's the best retail politician in West Virginia has seen since Arch Moore in 1970. So again, it's that personal, face-to-face value in West Virginia that explains his continued success and will explain his future success.
Mm. Well, we're getting a lot of comments online from listeners. Derek Wilmot says, this is sad. Manchin hides behind his Democratic Party mantle, but really acts like a Republican. Julie Hall says, my great-grandfather was a coal miner in Shenandoah, Pennsylvania in the 1890s. Great-grandfather, Julie says. Since then, we've walked on the moon and cured polio. Can't we find a better alternative to mining coal? Well, let's turn now to Washington. Sahil Kapoor joins us. He's national political reporter for NBC News. Sahil, it's good to have you back. Sahil, you with us? Okay, we're going to try and get him back on the line because we do want to know exactly what's happening in Washington, and there's quite a bit going on today. So, Robert Rupp, let me turn back to you. I'd like to hear a little bit more about how do you see Joe Manchin. His political longevity, I don't necessarily think, is in question, given what you said about his excellence in retail politics. But what do you think about his longevity as a Democrat in West Virginia?
The Republicans have, a long time ago, I think probably more than 10 years ago, the Republicans have been nourishing this view that because he is centrist, because he's conservative, they can win him over. And he was raised as a New Deal Democrat in a very Democratic family. I think A. James would come out of the grave if he changed. So despite the Republican wishes, I think Joe will stay as a Democrat.
It will be interesting to see. I mean, the New Deal Democrat part of him, it'll be interesting to see exactly how much he embraces that with this COVID relief plan. I mean, focusing on the stimulus checks is one thing, but maybe the rubber really meets the road if the GOP pushes on those other parts of their compromise bill. So let's turn back now and see if we have Sahil Kapoor from Washington. Are you with us, Sahil?
Yes, Magna, can you hear me?
I can now. It's great to have you. So give us a read on what's been going on with Senator Manchin over the past, day or two over the weekend and regarding his what he's been saying, what he's been thinking about the Biden plan.
Yeah, well, Senator Manchin has been expressing his preferences as to what should happen with the COVID relief proposal. And specifically, he's been saying, above all, that he wants it to be bipartisan. He wants the two parties to work together. He's also been saying, as you pointed out, that the stimulus payments, which have been a focal point of this effort, should be more targeted toward those who need him. The thing about Joe Manchin that I think people are missing is that when he talks about this, he's talking about his personal preferences. And he likes to be able to offer different opinions than the rest of his party for reasons I'll get into in a moment. But he's not drawing red lines here. That's a key thing that people are missing about him. He's not saying I'm going to refuse to vote for this bill if it doesn't, you know, if it does have higher stimulus checks. And I think that's kind of where that's what matters with Joe Manchin at the end of the day. He's trying to shape this, but he typically does vote with Democrats on these big economic plans. And the fact that Democrats even have this seat in West Virginia is kind of a miracle for the party, given that West Virginia is the Trumpiest state in the entire country, if you look at election margins. The former president won that state by 40 points in about 40 points in both of his elections. And without Joe Manchin, there is no Democratic Senate majority. There's no trifecta. So the reality is Democrats need Joe Manchin and the White House needs Joe Manchin more than Joe Manchin needs them.
Right. I mean, we've got some aides on the Hill being quoted in Politico as Joe Manchin controls everything right now. But tell us a little bit more then about why you were saying it's important for Senator Manchin to be able to express his personal opinions, which might go against the direction that, say, the Biden administration wants to hear him talk, even if he might still end up voting with them. Tell me more about why that's important.
Quite simply, the Democratic Party brand is cat food in West Virginia. It's a very, very bad party brand, and that's why they've been losing elections by such massive margins. Joe Manchin is kind of a unicorn where he's surviving politically on his own personal brand as an independent voice who is willing to break with his party. And he is outspoken about the areas where he disagrees, such as, you know, these stimulus payments, for instance, such as his voting for Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh, President Trump's first two nominees to the Supreme Court, and including his opposition to much of where the Democratic Party is on issues of energy and climate change, namely because, as you've discussed on the show, West Virginia is a cold state. So in order to maintain that personal brand of his that is critical to his political survival and his political identity, it means disagreeing with Democrats from time to time.
So, Sahil, you said that Joe Manchin wants to find a bipartisan solution. What exactly does that mean in this Congress?
That is unclear. And that's the key question to look out for at this point, because there is no bipartisan plan on the table that, at least unless it massively slims down President Biden's $1.9 trillion proposal. There is now 10 Senate Republicans talking about something in the range of $600 billion, but there's no fully fleshed out bill yet, and it's not even clear that those 10 will ultimately vote for that. So what Manchin is saying is that he prefers that a bill be bipartisan, and he wants to start off by working by the two sides working together. But the question then becomes, if Democrats do move to reconciliation, as it appears they are, is he going to vote no on that? There's no indication. There's no reason to believe he's going to stop them or he's going to vote no on that. I've asked him this question many times. Other reporters on Capitol Hill have asked him this question. He simply says now is the time to be working in a bipartisan manner, but he won't rule out reconciliation. And crucially, he has said he wants Joe Biden to be a successful president. That is the single biggest difference between him and any other Republican, that he's invested in making Joe Biden successful, which means he's more likely than not to support signature elements of Biden's agenda, even if there are parts of it that he ends up disagreeing with.
So, Jack and Professor Rupp, hang on here for one more second. I'm going to turn back to you in a moment. But Sahil, I do actually kind of have a nuts and bolts question for you, because we keep saying, you know, Joe Manchin, center of the Senate right now in terms of power and influence. But specifically, what role might or will Manchin play in ongoing or future negotiations over a COVID plan?
Specifically, he'll try to shape it.
Okay.
He'll offer his views, you know, on Capitol Hill. He speaks to reporters all the time in the hallway, myself included. He'll talk to his, you know, local West Virginia news reporters and offer his perspectives and opinions there. So he'll be vocal about where he is, what he wants and what he doesn't want. And Senator Chuck Schumer, the Democratic majority leader, is certainly attuned to what Joe Manchin wants, because this is a vote that he cannot spare in any path to 50 votes, whether it's reconciliation and bypassing a filibuster, and certainly 60 votes. It's hard to imagine a bipartisan deal that comes together without the support of Joe Manchin.
Yeah. So, Jack B., do you want to respond to what Sahil's saying?
Well, yes. But, you know, he's going to make a big vote pretty soon. It sounds like he's going to vote to convict the man who won his state by 41 points. And Joe, in his last race, by what I can see here, he only won it by 3 points. So that's pretty bold move, and on brand, maybe, showing that there's a Democratic side to him, too. And his comments about Trump, he's quoted here saying, how 72 million people could still walk in and vote for him, I just can't figure it out. Well, maybe his neighbors down there can explain it to him. But he's straddling, and it seems to me, on even hot issues like this impeachment, he's shown a little courage. Mm.
Robert Rupp, what do you think?
Yes, not only is he good a politician, but as pointed out, he's capable of taking bold actions. But I think the really key is, by his own personality, he wants to be in the negotiation. I think he's really enjoying the center, being the center of attention. But I think he'll continue being a force in West Virginia politics, and now he's, at least temporarily, he's going to be a force in congressional politics.
Professor Rupp, though, I am curious. I mean, we've been talking up Senator Manchin through this whole hour. There's got to be a risk for him as well, a potential downside. I mean, the backdrop here is the ruby red state of West Virginia. I mean, what are the risks for him right now in how he handles his role in President Biden's ambitious legislative agenda?
Well, I think he'll handle it well, because besides a personality, besides political talent, he has at heart what is best for the state.
Sahil Kapoor, same question to you. Can you get a sense of what the risks are for Manchin, or are there none?
There certainly are risks. And I think, as we've discussed on this show, Manchin is not a stranger to taking some aggressive positions, some risky positions. Keep in mind, he voted with the Democrats against the Republican efforts to repeal the ACA. Without him, there would have been that 50th vote in the Senate to pass that. It would be a massively different healthcare system than today. He voted against the Republican tax law of 2017. He did vote last time around to convict President Trump, and by all indications, he seems to be leaning that way again this time. So he does generally end up voting with Democrats, and that's the reason he is a Democrat. But having said that, again, the risks are, if he's seen as undercutting his independent brand, the one that has gotten him this far and that's allowed him to survive in this political climate that is so hostile to Democrats in West Virginia, if he's seen as just another typical Democrat, that would be a problem for him. That's the single biggest risk. And he has, through retail politics, through pressing his opinions, through, you know, the way he deals with voters and, you know, press in his state, he knows his way around it.
Well, Sahil Kapoor is national political reporter for NBC News with us today from Washington. Sahil, thank you so very much.
Great to join you.
And Robert Rupp, professor of political science and history at West Virginia Wesleyan College and author of The Primary That Made a President, Kennedy and the 1960 Battleground in West Virginia. Professor Rupp, it's been great to have you.
Thank you. Take care.
And Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst. Always great to have you as well, Jack.
Thank you, Magna.
And by the way, on the wall of Senator Manchin's office, there's a picture of John F. Kennedy and the quote, "Let us not seek the Republican answer or the Democratic answer, but the right answer." I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.